Welcome to Voices. I'm Alan Wilcox, Editor-in-Chief of Epidemiology. In 2002, the journal began a project to interview our field's most senior and accomplished practitioners. In these interviews, scientists reflect on their careers, their professional influences, and on the future of epidemiology. The interview you are about to hear is with George Comstock. Dr. Comstock began his career with the study of tuberculosis, an interest he maintained throughout his career, even as his research expanded into cancer and cardiovascular disease. He served for 2 decades in the U.S. Public Health Service and then joined the faculty at Johns Hopkins in 1962, where he established and directed the school's Field Training Center in Hagerstown, Maryland. He was editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Epidemiology from 1979 until 1988. He remained an active researcher and a reviewer for epidemiology until his death in 2007 at the age of 92. This interview was conducted by Dale Sandler in 2002.
I want to sort of start out by asking you to think about how you got started in epidemiology. I don't know too many people who actually start out life saying they want to grow up and be an epidemiologist. So how did you get to be an epidemiologist?
Well, I've always said I've been lucky all my life. And it probably started when I was in college. I went to Antioch where we worked part-time. Mm-hmm. And the job that I ended up in was with Eli Lilly in a group that was working on the plague group of Endophactor. And so we obviously knew all about Goldberger's stuff down south because, although, you know, I washed the glassware and cleaned the dog cages and not very high stuff, the people in charge really wanted me and my co-op to know as much about it as possible. So that gave me an introduction to that kind of epidemiology, nutritional epidemiology, and to the Public Health Service. And again, my boss was really directly responsible for my direction because I was interested in getting a PhD in biochemistry, and he said, "No, don't be a damn fool," he said. "You know, in one more year you can get your MD and you can do everything I can and lots more." Well, that made sense. And when I applied to medical schools, among those that accepted me was Harvard. And again, he told me, "Don't go to Case Western Reserve with all your pals, go to Harvard." And that was much better advice than I think even he knew, because in those days, Harvard was, and perhaps Hopkins, almost the only schools that didn't flunk out at third to a half of a class the first year. I don't know if I could have stood that kind of pressure or not. Harvard, and again, I think also Hopkins, felt that if you were good enough to get in, they were going to see that you got out, unless you really just, well, really made a complete flop. And the other thing that was real good about Harvard in those days, the students were pretty snooty, at least those that came from Harvard University, but the faculty was not. And that was quite different. Some of my friends who said their faculty would not speak to them if they met them on the street. Our faculty even invited us over to their house for dinner and things like that. So it was a wonderful environment. And I owe a great deal both to Antioch for getting me in that job and for Harvard for giving me what I think was a remarkable education from the social point of view as well as the educational point of view. Well, when it came time to look for an internship, I didn't have much money. And in those days, interns got nothing but room, board, and laundry, and residents got that plus $50. And so I thought, well, I'm really sort of interested in the Public Health Service, and the way to get in probably is to go intern with them. And if, you know, if I like them, that's a good chance to stay in, and if I don't, I will have earned enough money that I can afford to take an ordinary residency. Well, it turned out that I liked them and stayed in. Well, the other bit of luck was that when I came off sea duty near the end of World War II, I was immediately transferred to the newly created Division of TB Control. And I still don't know quite how that happened. Maybe somebody looked at my records and saw that I'd spent two summers working at a TB SAM. My guess it was just plain blind luck. Here's an able body getting off ship and ready for something and an opening. But, you know, maybe they really looked for something. And at that time, the guy in charge of it, Hellebaugh, was a remarkable person, a wonderful guy to work with, the kind of guy that could soft soap a senator and make him like it. You know, it was just unbelievable what he'd say to these people met. They just beamed all over is what he was saying to them. And beyond that, after a couple of assignments, well, my first assignment was in Cleveland, and Morton Kramer, who eventually became professor of mental hygiene here at Hopkins, He was a statistician, and I think largely due to the record system he set up, I was able to write a research-type paper. And I guess that's what drew attention to the research people to it. And Abe Lilienfeld and I were the two that were considered for the two research openings. Abe was sent to Philadelphia to what was, I think they thought that was going to be a real top-notch study because of all the big shots that were involved in it. And I got sent down to the country one down in Columbus, Georgia. Well, it turned out the Philadelphia study was a bust. And Abe was so unhappy with it that he resigned from the Public Health Service and went on to New York, where he made his reputation. And I drew the one down in Columbus, Georgia that really was a remarkable study, largely because it was under the direction of Carol Palmer, who is virtually unknown because he worked in TB all his life. But I've always said if he had done in any other disease area what he did in TB, he would be known as one of the world's greatest epidemiologists. And that was a tremendous break to work for somebody like that. And his successor, Shirley Farabee Wolpert, was an equally remarkable person. So that I fell into working with, well, four first and then later with two remarkable people. And then when I retired from the Public Health Service, we'd already had some contacts with Hopkins through Dr. Sartwell, who was one of the few epidemiologists that knew something about tuberculosis. And so I came to Hopkins, and, well, nearly 40 years ago now.
And you never wanted to practice clinical medicine, your Harvard medical training?
Well, in Columbus, Georgia, I ran the clinic, I ran the sanatorium, so I had the main problem was I could never find time to get away from patients to write anything. We had a little cabin up in the woods and I had no telephone. I used to just take a day off and go up there and tell them that it had to be a real catastrophe before they came after me. Mm-hmm. And the main reason I came back to school here was an opportunity to write up my interest in hypertension, which had developed as a sideline to tuberculosis. And so I had that contact with Hopkins before I retired, and even for the last five or six years of the Public Health Service, they let me come over from Washington to help with one course. So my contacts with Hopkins go back to 1954.
So when you first got started, what was epidemiology like? You know, what did an epidemiologist do? It seemed like it was potentially different from
statistics didn't enter into it in the sense that we think of it today. It was very elementary. You relied a great deal more on logic. Did this make sense biologically? You know, my first early papers, I don't think have a p-value or a significance or a confidence limit in them. Mm-hmm. And the biostatisticians were really what we would call today project directors, I think. You know, they knew how to do things, they knew what made sense, they knew what was unbiased, didn't know hardly any mathematics. Mm-hmm. So it was quite different from that point of view.
Have there been other changes in the way epidemiology was practiced then versus now?
Well, of course, there's all the technical things, you know, things you can do in serum and blood, and various, you know, like measuring bone densities and all those technical things that have come along. I don't think the basic principles of epidemiology have changed at all. It's just that we now rely more on statistical significance and less on what makes sense.
So do you think that's a change for the worse in the field?
It's a mixture. I think to the extent that we pay too much attention to statistical significance and not enough to replication, that's a backsliding. That's bad, I think. Because I think, you know, you can have a huge study with p-values with a string of zeros, but, you know, things can still happen. Chance can still throw you a curve. And to tend to rely on one big study, which seems to me to be the tendency with the NIH these days, you get a one big study by pooling, I think is a mistake. I think it would be much better. I would put much more faith in three relatively small values with borderline or even perhaps not quite significant values that all showed the same thing, done on different populations, somewhat different ways, than I would on any one big study with a very small p-value. And I think an awful good example of that was the University Group Diabetes Project, which is a fine study, and which showed that one of the oral antidiabetic drugs was associated with an excess of cardiovascular death. Well, if there hadn't been other studies underway, who would have had the courage to set up another study to see whether this was right? I think nobody would.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here's a big study, adequate numbers, well done, you know, probably one of the best studies, as good a study as ever has been done, I think. And to subject people to a drug that had shown bad effects on that. Fortunately, there were a couple of other studies underway that didn't confirm it, and we're now using oral diabetics. That, to me, is the prize example of how here a perfectly designed study, chance can, you know, it may be one in a 10,000, but one in 10,000 can be happening the very next time you go to come up.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the bad thing, that we do not rely enough on replication and rely too much on big studies with narrow confidence limits. On the other hand, you know, there's lots of things we couldn't do. Well, just take multiple regression, for instance. You know, we couldn't possibly handle those things. You look at some of the early studies, and the best they could do is analysis of variance. One set of three variables, another set of three variables, and then try to put all those together in your head. So a lot of our statistics, and you know, all the variance on multiple regression is a good example of the way of handling data that we didn't dream of, which I think has been a tremendous help.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's like everything else, I guess, in life. It's been some good and some bad.
Mm-hmm. So what about the flip side of statistics? What about the flip side of the reliance on statistics? There are a lot of people who complain that people run their things through a statistical package and produce a result.
Well, that's a great temptation, you know, just to pick up all your variables and run it through a regression and then report the results. And almost nobody, well, I see almost no evidence that anybody ever really looks to see which one of these things is most important in the way I think it should be done. They do stepwise, one way or the other. Well, the trouble with that is that your denominator is changing with each step because you've taken one out and not put it back in. In my opinion, the way to do it is to take something out, see what happens, put it back in, take another one out, see what happens, put it back in, so you're tending to keep the denominator as much the same as you can, taking one thing out. And that's a lot of work. Mm-hmm. I can't persuade any of our students to do it.
So over the years, there's been a lot of angst in the profession with students and faculty debating the issue of whether or not what the relationship between epidemiology and public health practice is or ought to be. And you hear people lamenting the fact that we've lost our roots in public health. Is this something that you've thought about, an issue of concern to you? Should epidemiology be the science of public health?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I think that is true. We have moved away. Take our department here. There are not many of us. In fact, I'm not sure if there are any other than myself who have any contact with public health departments. And I think that's too bad, because epidemiology, by definition, almost has to be the basic science of public health. It's the study of populations. Public health is provision of health services to populations. And I think most of our problems are not due to the discipline, but due to the two things. One is that there is not sufficient recognition by almost anybody that we're looking at associations, almost invariably. And that the media particularly wants to treat every study as if it were the final answer. And we as investigators get trapped into that because of the questions that the reporters ask us, and then the ones that they show on TV, for instance, or in the newspaper. That they not only point us in that direction and we follow along far too readily, but even if we've said you really need to replicate this, you really need to look back and see what other people have had, that doesn't tend to get into the story that gets the public. And so it's no great surprise that various critics jump on us, because that's what they see of epidemiology as it comes out. Mm-hmm. And even in, even in many of our written papers, all too often it's just that final sentence, more research is needed, without even specifying that it needs to be replicated in a slightly different way to see if it still comes out. And even then you can be wrong, as far as cause and effect is concerned. We're not humble enough, but what human being is?
I wanted to ask about setting up the training center in Hagerstown. How did you decide to do that? How did it come about?
Well, I guess, again, it was luck. The year before I retired from the Public Health Service, my wife and I were camping out in Washington County, and I still remember telling her as we came home that anybody ever offered me a job in a place like this, I sure would take it in a hurry. Well, the very next year, the Cancer Institute decided to stop the study of background radiation that they'd started. A building had been built specifically for that project, so that meant that was kind of embarrassing for them to stop a study for which there's a special building. The health department was a little upset at having an empty building on its grounds. And the Cancer Institute wanted to get information that would allow them to answer the question in one summer instead of the previous five summers, where only about a third of the county had been covered. So at that time I came along. Frank London, who is left in charge of a small epidemiologic unit out there, was a doctoral student in our department. So things just all fell together within a few weeks' time. So we decided to, we'd see what we could do in Washington County. B, the Cancer Institute, if we could do a private census. And I'd had some experience with that both in Georgia and in Alaska. And I realized what you could do epidemiologically if you had an enumerated census. And we could do it in such a way that would answer the question that the Cancer Institute was interested in. So that they gave us a contract to do it, which gave us our first project to get going. The county was not only amenable to our setting up there, or anxious for us to do that. And the idea of training came along mainly from John Hume's interest, who was assistant dean at that time. And he felt that we could use this research unit as a way to train people in doing public health research. Well, suffice it to say that we did do the census. We were able to answer the question about background radiation, and it turned out that the fact that there were certain old houses had more cancer than others, turns out that old people tend to live in old houses, and so the old people get cancer, so that was the answer to that, not the background radiation. And we actually, for a while, our supervision was in the Department of, what was it called, Public Health Methods in those days, or anyhow, whatever health policy, health management and policy was called back then. Well, it turned out that most of the use was being made by epidemiology students, so they shifted the administration of the unit to our department, although officially, even to this day, it is under the dean and not under the department. But practically, it's under the department. And it's gotten more and more that way. And so it turns out that the training tends to be just what we can do with field training with our own students. It's been a long time since we've had a student from another department. And actually, all the other departments tend to look at it as an epidemiologic project, mm-hmm. which makes me, well, it makes me sad, because I've had enough of a public health background. I would love to have seen the health policy people come in and do some actual work with the health department. Part of that, I think, is that the fact that our health department people were not chosen to have the kind of academic background that the school wants. And that has made it very hard for people in other departments to work with the health officer, to work with the other people we've had. The selection people have picked out very competent health officers, but without academic credentials. And I think that's why there hasn't been the interest. Maybe plus the fact, too, that Hopkins is really not interested in local public health. Yeah. I mean, let's just face it, they don't care about it.
I was going to ask you about that. So, you know, currently there's all kinds of interest in community-based research, and in fact, it's mandated in a lot of the grants that come out of my institute that you have community partners, and you have this sort of natural setting with the health department. But I wanted to know, you know, I guess you're saying it didn't really work, that there was this...
The only work with the health department has come through our particular unit there. Mm-hmm. And we have done a number of things with the health department, and our students have been involved to some extent, but really, considering that the thing has been, will have been in existence 40 years come this December, it's a pitiful amount of public health research. It's most epidemiologic research. Well, I think that's true. We have had students from other departments, but they're few and far between.
So is there some benefit, does the health department perceive some benefit to the center being there, or is there any
benefit? I'm very happy
to
say that they do.
Well, that's good.
And I think they do get some benefit. It's, you know, it's kind of a feather in their cap, I think. Uh-huh. And I've been there as, the most direct thing has been there as a consultant in chest diseases, tuberculosis primarily. We have been able to help them on a number of things when we've had TB cases that needed large-scale contact investigation. We've been able to muster students and residents to come help. We did a survey in one of the poorer neighborhoods that the results of which enabled them to get a grant, and now there's a operating clinic mm-hmm. with the health department of the hospital, although the hospital's gradually muscling the health department out. But I hope the hospital people don't listen to this. But it's the truth, they have. And at the moment, we are planning to do a survey of the health needs of the county in conjunction with the current health officer. And that we so far have not been able to find anybody at the school who's interested in working on that. So.
And what kind of relationship does the center have to the community at large? Is it perceived as something that's a benefit to the community? Do you have community advisors for the projects that you do? Do you get a better reception than the rest of us when we try to do a population-based study?
Well, you know, how does anybody ever know? I think as far as the various health-related agencies are concerned, we're perceived as being a useful unit. We've been very remarkably well accepted by the medical group of all sorts. It's hard to know. I think we have a good reputation. We've done everything we can to foster that. Mm-hmm. It perhaps tends to be somewhat more of a personal one than it should be, but after all, you can't put a training center on the TV. You can't put a person on TV. So, but mm-hmm. Sandy Hoffman, who has been my assistant now for the better, well, for more than a decade, she is active in the community and is being perceived as someone they look up to and admire. So she, you know, we're beginning to get at least one other person who is seen as connected with us. But we're actually thinking of trying to see if we can't get our name changed to Johns Hopkins Research Center. I sort of hate to give up the training, but you know, we're not really living up to that part of it, except training our students in how to do research in the field.
Mm-hmm. So when you started the CLUE study there, you know, now everybody wants to have a cohort with biologic samples, but you were pretty much a leader in that field. What were you thinking that you were going to use the samples for, and how did that project come about? The first
CLUE? Well, we actually used the name Serologic Precursors of Cancer was our primary thought, and Abe Lilienfeld should be given a great deal. You know, I've never always wondered, was it Abe's idea or was it my idea, or did it just come from the two of us together? I really, you know, I can't remember. You know, it's just one of these things that just suddenly came, or at least that's what it is in my memory. I think we both had a part in figuring this one out. And actually, my experience in Columbus, Georgia was somewhat of a learning experience as to how to, but by the time I was getting ready to leave, or the service was getting ready to transfer me, I was just beginning to realize what a gold mine I had beyond just the TB by virtue of having had a census of the community. Mm-hmm. And so I was able to put some of those ideas that were coming a little slowly down there into effect here in Washington County. And, you know, we gradually went into other samples. We've learned to collect plasma and other things, and we gradually learned to take toenails. Mm-hmm. And we've been doing a follow-up questionnaire. We've experienced what other people have. You know, our response rates have dropped from the 90s to the high 90s to the low 70s. But that seems to be the problem everywhere.
Yeah.
But I guess, you know, we're still a going concern, although again, there are enough other areas doing the same sort of thing that we have a lot more competition than we had at one time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's switch gears a little bit and think more broadly about epidemiology and influences on your career. And I wanted to ask you if there's somebody that you would single out as having had the greatest influence on your career.
Carol Palmer.
This is TV.
No question.
Yeah. And why is that?
Well, because his instincts were so epidemiologically sound. And, you know, he demanded epidemiologically sound work, and it always, you know, I like to think maybe I would have done it without that, but it certainly helps to have your boss wanting you to do that. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, I was very lucky, too, because Carol had, he knew exactly what he wanted, but he had great difficulty putting it into words. He wrote very few papers entirely on his own. He made very few speeches, mainly because difficulties in expressing exactly what he wanted. He didn't want to get up and give a general idea. He wanted to say exactly. And I can remember some parts of the paper that I'd take him home for every night for 2 or 3 weeks straight, changing 2 or 3 sentences. And he'd get back and say, well, that isn't quite it. You know, I really wanted this and this and this. And you go home and sweat blood over those 2 or 3 sentences again and bring it back. Well, it's closer, you know, but you haven't quite got it yet. It was very good training. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I was lucky enough to be picked to be one of the ones to do that sort of thing.
Epidemiology, as opposed to other sciences, tends to be collaborative. And I wanted to ask about what you thought were the essential ingredients of a good collaboration. And have you had some successful collaborations that you see as models for the way it ought to be done, and who with? Many part question. You can answer any part.
You just have to be nice to people. You know, there are people who go out as if they knew it all and tell the local folks what to do. They even tend to tell other people in other disciplines what to do. And, you know, everybody finds out quickly that doesn't work. You know, and all of us, I think, after we've been around a while, quickly find out what works and what doesn't. And you treat your collaborators like collaborators. I just have never had can't think of anybody I've had any trouble with. Well, sometimes the labs don't do quite as good a job as you like, or sometimes they don't always do what you want, but generally speaking, you can work those things out. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure we don't do things the way they want, too. It's a two-way street.
Who would you regard as the most important epidemiologist during your lifetime?
To the Carol Palmer.
Same answer.
To me, you mean, or to me in general?
In general, more in terms of impact on the field.
Oh, I don't know. You know, there's a lot of very important ones, and I'm sure if I sit down here and name 2 or 3, I will have left out half a dozen that I should have mentioned. Obviously, the ones that I was close to, Abe Lilienfeld, was remarkable, not only in the fact that he was so smart and could see things so well, but he was also very good at getting things going for other people. Well, for me, too. You know, he would certainly be in that group. I think Mervyn Susser has been more on the philosophical side, has been a great leader. And, you know, my beginning Alzheimer's catches me here where I can't think of names. Oh, John Castle. Boy, I think it was a tragedy when we lost him. Mainly because of his attitude towards the behavioral, the social aspects of epidemiology and the way in which he could interest people in it. You're talking about more or less contemporaries of mine, mm-hmm. I guess, not the historical ones. One person I do want to mention is Jerry Kornfield,
okay.
who would not want to be called an epidemiologist, but he was a remarkable biostatistician, a guy who had a sense for what we call epidemiology, and the ability to combine that with really good mathematical skills. Again, he's another one that we tragically lost far too early in his career. Gosh, who am I leaving out?
That's right. It's not high pressure. Okay. Do you have a paper of yours that you think was the most influential of the things that you've written? And on the flip side, do you have a paper that you thought was underappreciated?
Well, the paper that I had something to do with that probably was most influential was the very first paper reporting results of the BCG trials in Columbia, in Muskogee County, Georgia, and Puerto Rico. But that was, Carol Palmer was the senior author, and Larry Shaw and I were the other two. Now, do you call that my paper? I think that paper was largely responsible for the fact that BCG vaccination is not a routine vaccination in this country. If it had been, we would have been far behind where we are now in our knowledge of tuberculosis, because not having to worry about the tuberculin sensitivity caused by BCG, we've been able to do lots of things that the rest of the world can't do. There are many things that were learned in this country that could never be learned anywhere else where they use BCG. And fortunately, we don't need it.
So is there something that you worked on that didn't get the recognition that you thought it should have, or that you would have liked?
Well, I've had a number of papers saying how I thought they ought to, what they ought to be doing to evaluate any of the new vaccines they're working on that nobody's paid any attention to. You know, maybe the ideas aren't as good as I think they are. But I think if they had followed some of my suggestions 30 years ago, we'd be a lot better off now. We would have saved some of the strains that we knew whether they worked in people or not, instead of letting them go, and now we've got nothing to judge a new vaccine against. Mm-hmm. So they both tend to get into TB.
Okay. At the risk of getting the same answer, which of your contributions would you most like to be remembered for?
Oh, I guess, you know, obviously tuberculosis has been the common thread. You know, even now there's two or three papers, if I could possibly get enough time, I would be writing, and they would be on TV. But I've got other things, too. But I guess, you know, that's the thing that I think I know inside and out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to ask you something that I know the answer to, but perhaps you'd like to talk about your interests outside of epidemiology.
Well, I think I still, talking professionally, I think I still have a pretty broad interest in medicine in general and public health also. Outside of the profession, it's obviously been music, which may have been a mistake, but I can still hear the piccolos. You know, that's been essentially my only real hobby for years. I'm not sure it's a very, well, we'll find out whether it's a good one for an ancient guy.
Are you still going to bassoon camp? That's the important
question. We're planning
question.
To go this year.
Good.
Signed up for it.
Okay.
And go to a recorder workshop, too.
Good.
And my wife is beginning to take an interest in recorders.
Oh, good. So how has being at a school of public health influenced your work? Do you think it's made you practice epidemiology differently from if you had stayed in the public health service or had gone to a medical school or something else?
Well, the people who are trying to teach public health in medical schools got a tough row to hoe. It's probably a very important one, but it certainly is hard. You know, medical students, the appeal of clinical medicine is almost overpowering. It's just very hard to make a medical student at that stage of one's career interested in something that you can't touch and feel and see the results day to day the way you can when you're dealing with patients. And they tend to, unfortunately, they tend to pick up the attitude of their professors that public health is really a second-rate sort of thing, which is, well, obviously I think that's completely wrong. It's got some aspects that are far more difficult than anything in clinical medicine. Mm-hmm. Just like clinical medicine's got some things that are far more difficult than many things in public health. So that I don't really know how you best teach it in a medical school environment. I admire the people who are tackling it.
So what do you think the schools of public health should be teaching students these days?
I told you I was no philosopher. And the schools are all, I think, you know, there's so many schools. 30, 40 years ago, I thought I knew something about the dozen or so schools that existed. You know, Minnesota was strong on health education. And very, you know, we sort of knew what the strengths of each individual school was. Now they're all, they're much more equal, and they're all strong in many different directions. My statistical friends will not like me for saying this, but I think really we turn out far too many people who think that unless something is done with a very fancy mathematical model, that it isn't worth much. Mm-hmm. I think we need to, I need to have thought this through. I think one of the major problems of turning out so many PhD students, at least in this school and I suspect in other schools, is that there's far too much focus on the thesis. That students tend to come out exceedingly well trained in that area. And many of them just never pick up what I would consider an adequate biological background so they can shift gears readily later on. Now obviously people who are smart are going to do this much greater than other people do. And I think most of you PhD people outlive that, what I consider to be a handicap. I think we should be giving a broader and less intense education than we get through the usual procedure of working on a thesis. More coursework, perhaps actually more projects rather than the one great big one in different areas. I would just think, you're a PhD epidemiologist, you made me think I'm crazy. But I think that's the one advantage that those of us with an MD or broader medical background have is that it's easier for us to take up different subject matter. We may not handle it as well, and I think usually we don't.
Unfortunately, the questions I have left are these sort of philosophical questions, and so we'll get through them and see if you have some answers. What would be the single most important piece of advice that you could give to a new person starting out in epidemiology today?
I'm inclined to think my newly acquired grandson has just been at a meeting where he was able to talk with Watson, with DNA Watson, and Watson came over to him and said, "My boy, my advice to you is think." That seems like a fairly safe thing to say. It's, you know, and it's, when you're working very hard on a project, it's awfully hard to think of all the angles. And I think that would be my advice, is to try to get away from it and look at it and see, are there other things that I just haven't even talked, nobody's talked about, thought about. All too often I find, even after the paper's written and accepted, that, you know, maybe I missed another little point here that I should have thought of, because I was in too much of a hurry to get this thing off to the press. Mm-hmm.
In your opinion, what is what's been epidemiology's most important contribution to society? Or has there been a contribution?
Oh, it's rule and risk assessment, probably.
Do you want to say something about that?
No. Or just probably ought to, but I can't.
Okay. Is epidemiology in good shape, do you think? I mean, there have been a few articles written about epidemiology reaching its limits and so forth. Are you pessimistic about the future or optimistic, or neither?
Well, you know, there are obviously limits to epidemiology, because our subjects are not white rats in cages, but people living normal lives and behaving in ways that we have no control over. So yes, that's a limit, but if you don't do studies on people like that, you're not living in the right world, in the real world. And it's true, epidemiology can't do lots of things, but it can come closer than any other science.
Are there some opportunities that you see that we ought to be looking towards?
Just look at the back pages of all the epidemiologic journals. You know, it's amazing. Month after month after month, there's a lot of people who want epidemiologists. I think, well, you know, I'm about to branch off into the philosophy. One of the things that really worries me is the globalization of industry. And it may very well be that that industry becomes more important than government, and that epidemiologic studies that make industry look bad or make their activities look bad are going to be more and more difficult, because these companies are getting more and more powerful, have more money than universities, and they can severely punish people they don't like just by taking them to law, taking them to court. You know, it's possible to tie a study up, I think, for years.
Have you ever had that experience?
Living through it right now.
Hmm.
And I can see my time taken up for weeks to come, just trying to answer what they want, or keep fighting to keep them from getting it.
So why do you think so many epidemiologists don't pay attention to policy? And, you know, the Society for Epidemiologic Research has always had this "we don't do policy" kind of attitude, and yet there are, I guess I would agree with you that there are these new inroads made by industry and...
Well, there's the attitude of all scientists that they shouldn't be advocates. If you're an advocate, you're taking a position and you're no longer unbiased. And there is something to that. On the other hand, if your research is likely to be more focused and more useful if you do have an interest and you are an advocate, well, Goldberger... No, he was an advocate for the nutritional thing of it.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to just sort of come back to the opportunities. So, you know, there are opportunities people want epidemiologists, but are there scientific questions that you think we ought to be looking towards or taking advantage of different technologies? You think where, you know, what direction should epidemiologists be thinking about going?
Well, you know, I've never been that kind of a guy. I've always taken the opportunity at the moment to do what I could with what I had. It was terrible. I've never had a long-range plan for my life. I've just done what comes up and tried to do it the best I can. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the reasons I guess I'm not a philosopher. Well, obviously, name any disease you can think of. And there are aspects of how best to prevent it that we're far from knowing the answer. Mm-hmm. You know, even take the well-trodden one of smoking and lung cancer, you know, just what is it that does it? And what is there some way we could do it? And that, you know, and that's probably the most trite subject you can think of. And there's so many other things, and all other cancers, almost every other disease, there's still, we're a long ways away from being able to really prevent it. And of course there's a great deal of interest in genetics now, and I think genetics will help. I don't think it's going to be the great solution to all the problems that sometimes people think. But so obviously that it impinges on probably almost everything to some extent. In some instances it's overwhelming, and in some places it's trivial, but we certainly don't have much idea about the gene environment interaction, how that works. And even worse, we haven't any idea how we can ethically manipulate it to make life better for people. You know, no matter where you turn, the hundreds of unanswered questions.
Mm-hmm. Right. So my last question is actually not a broad question, but thinking about your experiences as an editor of a journal, I wondered, to what extent do editors and journals shape the field, or are the journals merely a reflection of the field?
I've never talked to anybody about this, so I don't know if I'm right. But I have the feeling that editors these days do very little to shape the field. That their principal concern is to get scientifically sound and useful papers published. But without consciously stimulating them in one particular direction or another, if that's so, I've not been aware of it in any journal I can think of. Certainly I was a relatively laissez-faire editor in that sense. Never occurred to me to say, well, I don't want to publish this because I'm trying to push the field in this direction. Mm-hmm. I wonder if any editor, even the big ones in the past, maybe so. I'm trying to think of things like the Journal of the American Medical Association, which is obviously the voice of the American Medical Association. I doubt that very many papers were turned down because they were against the policy. Mm-hmm. They were turned down because the editor didn't think they were of interest to enough people, or sound papers, things like that, is my guess. Lord knows, I wasn't in their editorial offices. Mm-hmm. But certainly, I don't think in the journal, in my association, the American Journal of Epidemiology, that's what I mean by the journal, I don't think Moises does that. I know I didn't do it. I don't think Neil Nasonson did it. But that's putting thoughts into other people's heads.
Okay. Okay. I had given you some of the questions in advance, and so you may have given some thought to the questions, and there might be something that I didn't ask you, or I ask it in the way you remembered it as having been written down. So was there anything else you wanted to share? Sort of about the field, about your career, about where,
well,
what the future should
hard
hold.
Hard for me to think of doing anything else that would have been more fun, which is the main reason I keep on going.
Thanks for listening to Voices, a project of the journal Epidemiology. We hope you enjoyed it. You may also be interested in a short video clip of this interview, which you can access through the journal's website. An edited version of this interview was published in the September 2003 issue of the journal.